which is wonderful, on a Saturday afternoon. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to our final plenary panel and session on Pathways Forward. And before I invite our panelists to come up onto the stage, we have a special, very short presentation for you from our young leaders. And they're going to share with us what this experience has meant to them and how they're going to carry it forward. And we thought it might be a good way to begin this final session, which is about where we go from here and how do we ensure and sustain equitable and democracies respectful of human rights. So I would like to invite the young leaders to do their presentation, and I'll watch.
Good afternoon, everyone. Are my supporters behind me? Yes. On behalf of the International Young Leaders, now officially the 2013 class of McGill-Eckenberg Fellows, representing 22 countries from around the world, it is my honor to introduce our contribution to the Global Conference. Before we share with you our thoughts, I must first offer our most profound gratitude to the organizers of this dynamic, exceptional initiative. McGill University, including its student volunteers, Professor Nandini Ramunanajam, the conference organizing committee, inspiring speakers, our sharp and patient facilitator, Teddy Rouge, and last but certainly not least, Gordon and Penny Eckenberg. Thank you for creating the opportunity that has united this group of disparate, talented individuals into a family dedicated to supporting one another as we advance human rights and democracy around the globe. Everyone on the stage in front of you has discussed how the past week forced us outside of our comfort zones and challenged our pre-existing notions. Indeed, many of us have remarked that we learned the most from each other, both through respectful dialogue and the occasional conflict, including with snowballs. As a group, we struggled to determine how to use our remarks to best capture our experience here. Montreal's beckoning nightlife was not our only barrier in this endeavor. In the end, we designed a contribution that showcases our diversity, creativity, and the common bonds that unite us. Most importantly, we are here to offer a three-point pledge that outlines principles and actions that each of us took from the conference and will apply to our future work. Our aim is not to be comprehensive or all-inclusive, but rather to spotlight the main areas where we will target our efforts. Our commitment to you today comes through group consensus, often in the context of late-night debate, and with the input of every 2013 McGill-Eckenberg Fellow. We hope that you enjoy.
Hello, I'm Natasha from Macedonia. As young leaders, we are each working on our own and very diverse fields of human rights. Through our vigorous debates this week, however, we have been pushed to challenge our preconceptions and have each come to the realization that one cannot create a hierarchy of human rights, picking or choosing the rights one opts to defend. To be a human rights activist, one must believe in and defend all human rights. Selective application of human rights only serves to reinforce the perception of states conceding rights rather than human beings exercising those rights themselves. After this week in Montreal, we young leaders believe that human rights are only upheld when they are defended without exception and without hierarchy. The first component of our commitment here today encompasses this conviction. Thank you.
My name is Rab, and I'm from Pakistan. We young leaders commit ourselves to promoting the universality of human rights by upholding all human rights without exception. Thank you.
My name is Caitlin, and I'm from Canada. Silence is a weapon of mass destruction. This very tweetable statement made by Marina Nemat at the opening of this conference resonated profoundly with all of us. Throughout our lives, each of us has experienced attempts to silence our voices and the voices of marginalized groups. Freedom of expression and open, respectful debate are essential components of democracy. Throughout this week, we have struggled with where to draw the line between hate speech and freedom of expression. But we have come to the conclusion that regardless of differences of opinion or even differing views of what the facts are, our voices should not be silenced. This conclusion is expressed in the second point of our pledge.
My name is Alejandro and I'm from Bolivia. We young leaders pledge to ensure that other young leaders are free to express their ideas, regardless of whether or not others agree with them. We will also strive to build a more democratic society that promotes and ensures the free exchange of ideas for all. Thank you.
My name is David Medina, and I am from Honduras. Since our first interaction on our young leaders blog, 6 months, 12 days, 18 hours, and 30 minutes ago, we have built a community based on solidarity across borders and respect for diversity, with universal human rights as a reference point. We as young leaders recognize the challenges of generational change in the leadership of our societies. Like all of us in this stage, young leaders around the world are overcoming stereotypes, age discrimination, and addictions to Facebook to advocate for democracy and human rights. Having earned the privilege to be here, we believe that to have a responsibility to ourselves, to each other, and to other young leaders. The third and final component of our commitment as young leaders binds us to this responsibility.
My name is Fatmata, and I'm from Sierra Leone. We young leaders will nurture our fellowship of activism and mutual support, empower other youth to be forces for good in their societies, and encourage leaders of all ages to promote changes across generations.
At this point, we would like to invite Gordon and Penny Eckenberg, as well as Nandini Ramanujam, onto the stage to formally present them with our final declaration. So if you wouldn't mind, would you join us on the stage, please? On behalf of all the 2013 young leaders, I would like to present you with our final declaration, which symbolizes our commitment to promoting human rights and democracy in our personal lives and in our careers. And thank you very much indeed for all your hard work.
I just wanted to add, we are all young leaders, but there's one person in the putting together of this process that emerged as our leader and has really put in a lot of work and demonstrated some pretty impressive organisational capabilities to put this together, and that's Nick Collins. So thank you, Nick.
Okay, so if the panelists could please, come on. And does everyone have their microphones? Do you have your microphones? I don't think we need that one. Karen, did you get a microphone? Okay, great.
Jake, you want to?
Okay, thank you to the young leaders for an inspiring presentation, and to the organizers of the Young Leaders Forum as well. And I think it's a very appropriate starting point for our session this afternoon, which, as I mentioned earlier, is on Pathways Forward, Sustaining Democracy in Turbulent Times. And it's now, this panel is designed to address and raise problems and obstacles and challenges facing emerging and established and long-standing democracies. But beyond identifying problems and challenges, it will also highlight concrete mechanisms for addressing those challenges in terms of anti-corruption, movements against corruption, movements to ensure the freedom of political prisoners, movements for the building of institutions for engagement and participation in the protection of human rights and in democratic governance. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you our three superb panelists. And we have on our panel today Dr. Karen Bedi, who is an Indian social justice activist and anti-corruption advocate, Mr. Jared Genser, who's the managing director of PIRSA Strategies and founder of Freedom Now, and Ms. Mekde Mezgebdu, who is program officer of United Nations Development Program and a McGill-Eckenberg Fellow. And I'm going to introduce, first of all, our first speaker, Dr. Karen Bedi, and I will then provide a more complete introduction to our other two speakers just before they speak. So we will have three presentations, a presentation by each of the speakers, and then I'll open up the floor for a final exchange of ideas and questions. So our first speaker, as I mentioned, is Dr. Karen Bedi, who is a renowned social activist and who has spent 35 years working to advance reforms in policing and in prison management. Prior to her retirement in 2007, she was India's first and highest ranking female police officer. In 2003, she became the first woman ever to be appointed to as Indian police, civilian police advisor to the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations. Dr. Bedi is a former Nehru Fellow, and she holds both an LLM and a PhD. She's the author of numerous books, and some of which are on display in the lobby, if you're interested. Dr. Bedi has been involved in numerous initiatives in the areas of education, environment, healthcare for urban and rural poor. Most recently, she's been at the vanguard of a nationwide campaign against corruption. And so without further ado, I'd like to have you join me in welcoming Dr. Ben.
All right, let me go through this.
Yeah, you can press that.
And then we do this.
Yes.
Let this go.
Do you want it?
Perfect.
Do you want to sit or stand?
I'll stand.
Okay.
And this is the forward. Right. I want to thank, let me begin by thanking all of you for bringing me to Montreal all the way from New Delhi. It's exceedingly cold here. Very cold. Biting cold. But then I have the warmth of my sister here, who happens to be a Canadian living in Montreal. That's it, Dr. Rhoda. Anyway, thank you all, hosts. It's always a pleasure coming to challenging conferences, more from the weather point of view. Now, I thought I would introduce you to where I come from, but let me tell you how good I'm feeling after having heard the little prior panel. I almost felt living in India after having heard what happens in certain parts of the world a dream place, almost a dream place. I felt so good that here I'm living like an absolute free bird. Once having had the opportunities, those of us in India who have the opportunities, I think democracy is at its best and a better way to go. So here I'm going to share with you where I feel good about it and where we've got to go further. Here is India's world's largest democracy, as you see. Look at the parliament constituencies, 543, assembly seats, 4,032, registered political parties, 220 only. And look at the number of villages we elect is 638,000. Look at the electorate which elects these people. It is combined population of entire Europe. It crosses entire Europe, or it is more than the entire American countries. 731 million, or North and South American countries, 910 million population. And look at our population. That's the 1.2 plus billion people we're dealing with. No wonder it's India, world's largest democracy. And the electorate is just not few million. It's 728 million, though this figure varies with my next slide. But that's the gigantic scale of India's challenging democracy. Look, the next slide. Oh, I didn't move the slides. That's why you weren't a little amazed. I was all reading for myself. So look at the scale. I talked about the population. It combines the entire Europe, or it combines the entire Americas. And look, is there this? So if you look at these two also, this is what is India's population, world's largest democracy. And that's the electorate which goes to vote. These are the number of voters India has. Polling stations, 1.18 million electronic voting machines, 1 million women in rural leadership all elected. These are the challenges by and large, fair and firm elections. I'll tell you why I say this. It's not here, I'm not here to gain any brownies or medals, but I thought I must tell you what is right and what is not right with my country. Even if there is one village remote and there is one voter, a polling station is put up so that that one voter has a right to vote. So these are the... So these are the challenges of Indian voting. But, as I said, there is a clamor in India for more democracy and not less. Why? I'll come to the next slide. But there is, despite this huge democracy of the largest electorate, there is a clamor for more. And that's what brings me here for this conference. What is that clamor? My presentation is divided into three parts: democracy, law enforcement, and activism. So I'm going to divide my next 18 minutes into this. So what is this? It is a clamor to say, let me go to the next slide that settles this. The clamor for that this is not acceptable. If you see, this is the parliament. And that's a parliamentary form of democracy. And see what happens. You have a deadlock, you have a walkout, you have people, you have a resignation, you have standoffs, you have washouts. All this is still happening. You have terror, you have inflation, you have India Against Corruption movement, of which I was a part. You have the terrorism through the Naxalites here. Does it work here? No, it doesn't. The battery's gone off, I think. Okay. I was bringing it here, but doesn't come. So this is the clamor for more. This is the fight against. If you're trying to pass a vote of no confidence, then for jolly well say, who will govern? And not just everybody gets thrown out. You've got to have who will govern the country. At the moment, the parliamentary form of government doesn't have the German kind where it'll say, I vote you out, but I vote the following in. The country needs to be governed. That's why we're talking about more democracy. Second part of the Indian democracy is where we've had numbers of members of parliament involved in criminal records. We don't have a system to throw them out. We, in our system, We, unless they're convicted and their appeal not stayed, they stayed on. They stay on to legislate. And we as activists are saying, this is conflict of interest. How can a lawbreaker continue to be a lawmaker? So this is a challenge before the current democracy. That's why it's called bad manners but good democracy. We raised our voice against them. So we got 153 of them in a house of 550 plus. We got 153. So that's one of our major demands for the current democracy in the current system. And then the problem of tax havens, where most of these people keep their money. I mean, why should we have them, I wonder? Norway, Jersey Island, Delaware, Cayman Islands, Belize, Cyprus, Luxembourg, Dubai. All of my Indian money is right here. How can you have human rights with all the money right here? How do we create a system by which we could dilute them? Or the UN convention, somewhere the UN conventions, need to disqualify them. This is eating into the vitals of democracy. This is vitals, because most of my major Indian money, if we weren't having these, we would have had a surplus budget. But we have a deficit budget. And that's where it eats into the infrastructure of the common man. I think that's a very big challenge for Indian democracy, or any good democracy. And then it makes bad politics. Bad politics makes bad economics. When a voter starts getting used as a consumer, and the freebies culture comes in, it's a voter as a consumer. That's contrary to good democracy. And that's where it is happening in India, that many of our voters are being given freebies like laptops, like frigidaires, like serving machines and so many things. So this is what we are also actively engaged against. Again, the question of where arithmetic has replaced leadership. This is the way he looks at. This is the way our leader is meeting the common man and is saying, this is a vote bank. So this is not right democracy. How do we find ways to eliminate these? These are the challenges before liberal democracy today. Who leadeth me? I think that's a real question. The question is, if there is a difference between being elected to lead and being able to lead. I think good democracies necessarily do not throw up the best candidates who are capable of leading. So you have candidates who freely and fairly elected, but is not the right candidate because you don't have a right to reject. You don't have a right on the voting machine to say none of the above. So many of us activists around the country are actively engaged in having this right, saying right to none of the above. Now that needs a system, and this needs engagement. Having worked with the United Nations, I think these are some of the challenges before international organizations and United Nations in particular. And then democracy includes women. We've had a lot of problems concerning women in Indian democracy, where women rape, particularly rape, has been a serious crime. And it's a very serious mindset, because India is both a developed country, a developing country, and an underdeveloped country. India has three continents in one country, where you have three kinds of segments, which produces women like me, who have the best of the opportunities, the best of the school, the best of the profession, and then you have those with inadequate and those with none. So where do women, unless women are included in a democracy, they're a very big vote bank. But what kind of strategies do we adopt so that the women do get included in a democracy? So our democracy must empower voters, where you have town hall meetings on a regular basis, by right. How do you be inclusive? Where you have institution building, where the bureaucracy delivers. The bureaucracy is not accountable, which I'm talking about the civil service. India's civil service is the best selected and least accountable. Growth and institutions double standards on development. The key is here. Developed countries argue that good institutions are essential for economic growth in poor nations. But development of institutions is a consequence of economic growth, not the other way around. I guess we got to decide what is right. Involving people in decision making. We've been in our entire civil society movement, which we did the whole of last 2.5 years, We asked for demanded town halls. We wanted co-option in drafting an ombudsman and anti-corruption bill. But the people, the elected representatives said, it's we the people who you the people have elected. We said, no, it's we the people who you who are the ones who are doing duty for us. So it's been defining who is we the people. The elected representatives thought they were we the people. We the voters were thinking we the people. I, as a democracy, we need to decide who are we the people. This is all about the bureaucracy, as I said. They stand, these are the people who are coming from amongst us. What kind of work we do as bureaucrats? I've been a bureaucrat with the United Nations, and I know the United Nations also doesn't have always the best of the bureaucrats. So this is the backbone of any democracy, how the bureaucrats deliver. That was my first segment of the democracy. Now I want to bring you to the policing angle, which is 35 years of my life. I cannot imagine any democracy worth its salt without a policing which is free from political controls and which only is accountable to the rule of law. Indian policing is two ways. It's got one foot in political control and one foot in the rule of law. Somewhere's individuals, some of us, are, there are many very good, courageous officers who put both their feet in the rule of law. And some timid people who are looking for patronage put both their legs in the political control. I cannot imagine any good democracy without effective, independent policing. So we can't have a policeman as a spectator. And we have to empower our policemen to become strong law enforcers. So we've got to be challenging this. I will come to the conclusion, the suggestion concerning this in the end. So this is the way an Indian politician looks like. Even though he's been elected by a lot of people, he's a fat man who's overeaten a lot and who's guarded by these cops most of the time. So you have one, you have three cops sometimes for one one politician to be protected. And you have one policeman sometimes for 700 people back in the public. So this is another area which we are questioning this time completely before the impending elections. We want this to change. And here's this cartoon which says, the real goat escape of, we got a scapegoat, sir. So this has to change if you really have to have a meaningful democracy. So here they are to protect and serve while they are so scared of the same people who they have treated as arithmetic. This is not good democracy. This is not the right policing for a right democracy. This is what I wrote a piece a couple of years ago. The ideal would be the Gandhi kind of people making as police chiefs who are co-opting, who are in the center of leadership and not on the top of a hierarchy. They who are not outside the system, but who are within the system. And this is a good democracy, good practice, where universities are linked with policing. This is a very good example from Stanford, where this is a good American practice, and I'm sure it is Canadian in liberal democracies, where, and it is an essential practice of a democracy, where research institutions, universities get linked with policing and constantly evaluate their policing practices so that they are actually meeting the needs of the people. Now, this is about my third section of the presentation, is about us, a billion of us, are, who were in our aspirations for a better law. We fought for an anti-corruption law in the last 2 years, and this is one of those pictures of some of us activists who played that role. We were asking for India a proper ombudsman. Where middle class in India, around these countries, have grown. Middle class in India is asserting in a very big way, which is driving the change. This is the key. You really need a 365-day code for conducting, for conduct of political leaders. I think we need to have this United Nations to evolve this. This should become, just as the United Nations Convention Against Corruption is a treaty, which is most of the countries have signed it, I think this is another homework for the United Nations to do, or coming together of universities to do. This was the uprising book I have some for some of you. How did we do this uprising? How did it go through? These are two books I've got for you, any one of you interested. One is my book called I Dare, which documents this and the policing. and the second one is the Uprising 2011. And this is all not my views, the way newspaper clipped it. It's a moving history of the ways newspapers were reporting our movement from day to day. Friends, this is how the movement was for 2.5 years. This is the way it looked. It was truly national. Now I have these final conclusions to say what is needed. And I was yesterday, that one thought which struck my mind and doesn't leave me. Is there a need for one, essential need, when we get together groups like these and universities like McGill take a lead and some very, very interesting leadership is so committed and passionate about setting these movements and founding these movements. I think there is need for international bodies, and that's my firm recommendation for this conference. Need for international bodies or universities to come together as coalition of universities, of law schools, coalition of law schools, coalition of management schools, coalition of universities. To do what? To rate each other's countries, particularly those countries who are claiming to be liberal democracies at least, rate their judiciary, rate their political leadership, rate their policing, and publish these ratings through students' projects, through academic projects of universities. I tell you, it works. Just as Transparency International corruption indices work, just as GDP works, just as the Women Development Index works, so does this will work. We need to come together as coalitions. Universities as coalitions. McGill here, Harvard Law School there, Yale there, another law school, some other law schools in Europe, law schools in India, law schools around in the liberal democracies. Let us come together and start rating judiciary. Because these are unaccountable institutions in a democracy which have a very strong bearing on human rights. Indian judiciary, not my judiciary, judiciary. Political parties, democracy within them, political leadership, parliament functioning, policing. If we start coming together as coalition and start rating them by parameters and letting these as be student projects, they will be considered unbiased and they will have a great impact on these institutions, because these institutions, having bearing on good democracy, having bearing on human rights, are opaque. They are not accessible to rights of information, which my country enjoys. Judiciary is out of it, policing is out of it, political parties auditing is out of it. Now, these are the challenges, to my mind, Colleen, we have for the emerging democracies or established democracies. And these annual surveys should get internationally published. I can tell you they will have a strong support back home, because we as civil society then will be able to say, see, this is what has happened. You better, it will give us a peg to strike, peg to agitate, peg to seek improvements. Thank you so much.
Inspiring and important for us to think about the responsibility and the role of universities, of students, and of those in our positions and our engagement with other actors, public and private actors, in society. And so we'll perhaps take this up in the discussion. I want to turn now to our second, and also your point at the end in terms of the international level leads us directly into Mr. Jared Genser's contributions and engagement in human rights. And I want to just say a few more words and then turn the floor over to him. Jared Genser, and just, I must say, take a look at him, because his picture, we had a slight mix-up with the photos in the program. So here he is, and disregard the photo you have in your program. So I apologize, apologies for that, and we'll correct it on our website. Mr. Genser is Managing Director of Persis Strategies and founder of Freedom Now, a nonprofit organization that works to free prisoners of conscience through legal, political, and public relations advocacy efforts. And Mr. Genser has just been an enormous contributor in working to free political prisoners across the world. In winter 2008, he also was a lecturer at the University of Michigan Law School, teaching a seminar on the UN Security Council in the 21st century. He's also been a visiting fellow with the National Endowment for Democracy. His clients have included famous dissidents and imprisoned political prisoners, including, just to name a couple, the Czech Republic president, Václav Havel, and the Nobel Peace Prize laureates Aung San Suu Kyi and Desmond Tutu. He is both a young global leader of the World Economic Forum and a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Mr. Jared Genzer.
Thank you all very much, and thank you to McGill and the Eckenberg family for hosting this wonderful conference. I'm really thrilled to be here. I'm always happy to come to Canada. My wife is Canadian, so I couldn't find a nice American woman to marry, and so I had to come all the way up here, and much like Americans have come up north and taken your fur pelts and your lumber, we've also come up here and, invited your women to come south. Given the broad topic for this closing panel, I'm going to focus my remarks on one segment of this important puzzle of sustaining democracy in turbulent times. And it's the fact that all of the civil and political rights that we exercise, including the rights to freedom of expression, association, and religion, can only be exercised if a population in any given country maintains the right to be free from arbitrary detention. And to that end, I'm going to speak to you today about Freedom Now, the NGO that I founded a dozen years ago to free prisoners of conscience around the world. The reason that we exist is because of the brave people that, on a daily basis, put their lives at risk fighting for freedom, democracy, and human rights. And it's been a real pleasure and honor to meet many of them here at this conference. The core of our mission is to support them when their activities put them in harm's way. And the brief time that I have, I thought it might be most interesting for me to describe a little bit of how I got involved in the work, how Freedom Now does what it does, because I think it's relevant to get to practical discussions of how to advance human rights around the world, and talk about some of those strategies and how they've worked in some of the individual cases that we have actually worked on. I'm often asked what led me to start an NGO that works to free prisoners of conscience. After all, it's pretty frustrating and sometimes kind of impossible work. In March of 2000, I was a law student at the University of Michigan Law School, and I was interning with the Human Rights Organization in London. And I picked up the Evening Standard before getting on the tube ride home and read in the newspaper about James Maudsley, a 27-year-old British national who was imprisoned in Burma. Several years before, he had witnessed the brutality of the military government in Burma when it torched the village that he was teaching English in. And he began a one-man campaign against the military junta. In the fall of 1999, he returned to Burma and began distributing pro-democracy leaflets. And by the end of the day, he had been arrested and received a 17-year prison sentence in solitary confinement. After his parents agreed to work with us, I filed James's case before the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. The Working Group is an independent and impartial body at the UN, which is now part of the Human Rights Council. I got members of Congress involved, including a bipartisan letter written to the Burmese government urging his release, and I work closely with the State Department and the British Foreign Office. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, and we had a few things come together on his case that led to his release. And by the time I returned to my last semester of law school, not only had we won our judgment at the United Nations, which found that he was being held in violation of international law, but as we were making the decision public, the British government reported that he had been beaten up in his prison cell. He actually got pretty smart during his imprisonment. He realized that if he was beaten up after a consular visit, he wouldn't see his consulate for another month, and the bruises would heal. And so he knew to provoke an attack on himself right before a consular visit. He knew the UN opinion was coming, and he timed a protest within his cell to get beaten up right before the consular staff showed up. And with word of these two developments coming out in the same week, outrage mounted swiftly. And a very short time later, several days later, the Burmese government caved. And I received a call in my law school dorm that he was being released. I quickly hopped on a plane to London, and a few days later, James arrived after 416 days in solitary confinement. And I watched from 10 feet away his private reunion with his parents, his sister, and his twin brother, embracing in a private lounge right off the runway. And James came over to me and was introduced to me by his mother and gave me a firm handshake and said, "Thanks, you saved my life." And we all cried. And it was an extraordinary moment, and needless to say, I was hooked. And a decade later, James remains an activist. He's currently actually studying to become a Catholic priest and will be ordained in about 2 years now. And reflecting on this experience, however, I'm not sure what gave me the audacity to take on the Burmese regime. But I soon realized that as a law student and as merely one person who wanted to make a difference, that I could impact people's lives. And therefore, I felt incredibly empowered. That said, however, I also wasn't overly impressed with myself. I'd gotten a white guy out of a Burmese prison. And the real question was whether the rough formula that I had stumbled across could be applied successfully to a Pakistani in a Pakistani prison, a Chinese person in a Chinese prison, and so forth. And so in 2001, I gathered a group of friends together to found Freedom Now. And our mission is to free prisoners of conscience through focused legal, political, and public relations advocacy efforts. Since that day, we've gotten numerous other prisoners of conscience released. Imagine recommending a book to a friend. This is what our client Ayub Masi, a Pakistani Christian, was accused of doing. He received the death sentence for blasphemy in Pakistan for allegedly telling his neighbor to, quote, read that book by Salman Rushdie, referencing the satanic verses. Now imagining publishing an article critical of your prime minister here. Our client, Louis Mejo, received a 3-year prison sentence for doing just that about President Biya of Cameroon. After we secured his release, he returned to publishing his newspaper. And now imagine being in prison for participating in a protest on campus. Yangzhan Li, who was here earlier at this conference, was a former client of mine. He was a Chinese scholar and democracy activist sentenced to 5 years in prison as a spy for Taiwan after returning to China to observe labor unrest there. And he has thankfully been able to return to his important work. And of course, you had an opportunity to see how extraordinary an individual he is and the contributions that he can make to advancing freedom and democracy in China. It's our firm belief that by defending the defenders, the impact of our work is multiplied, not only by enabling human rights defenders to return to their important work, but also by the legal precedents that we set and the broader awareness that we raise about the human rights situations in the country in which we work. Now let me start to tell you a little bit more about how Freedom Now does what it does. First, we only represent individual prisoners as our clients, which means we're retained by a member of their family. This gives us the authority to rally governments and organizations and speak authoritatively on a person's behalf. So, as an illustration, in 2005 to 2010, we represented Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi of Burma. Previously, although this was a surprise to me at the time when her family first approached me, nobody had actually represented her as an international lawyer, and advocacy on her behalf was really all force and no vector. And by that, what I mean is everybody wanted to work on her case, which is, of course, a wonderful thing, but what it means is that there was no incentive for human rights organizations to work together. And so one organization wanted to do one set of things, and they went off and did it. And another did the same in a different direction. And there was no coordination, collaboration, or incentive to work together. Once we got involved as her international lawyer, however, we were able to say, this is what the family would like to do next. Can we all work together? It isn't about credit. It isn't about which organization is out front. It's just about getting the darn job done and doing the most effective thing collaboratively so that we can actually have that impact. So as an illustration, we worked together to recruit a group of 112 former presidents and prime ministers from more than 50 countries around the world to urge UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to travel to Burma and to press the regime for her release and that of other, at the time, 2,100 other political prisoners. On the day the letter was sent, the former Norwegian Prime Minister, Kjell Magne Bondevik, with whom Freedom Now had worked, spoke to the Secretary General, who immediately convened a group of friends of Myanmar meeting at the UN. And literally within 6 weeks, he made a historic first trip to Burma. Many of you will recall the images of Aung San Suu Kyi's release in 2010, the day that she popped her head up over the wall of her home. And since her release, a new president, Thein Sein, has taken office. Aung San Suu Kyi has been elected to the parliament. And serious changes are taking place in the country. In fact, I've now been back to the country twice since December. I'll be going 2 more times in the next several months. I myself was on the Burmese government's blacklist for many, many years. And so one can see that by mobilizing support on behalf of this one particular political prisoner, who happened to be a pretty important one, as the case would turn out, that you can make a contribution. We would never take credit for her freedom. It was a collective effort on the part of many, many people. But we were able to make an important contribution to try to facilitate some serious changes, which are now beginning to really start to take hold in a country of 50 million people. Secondly, we sequence legal, political, and public relations advocacy to have the maximum possible impact. Take a moment to be and imagine yourself being put on trial for advocating for people of all faiths to worship as they choose. and to say, and let's say you've been arrested for this crime and you wanted to defend yourself at your trial. This is what happened to our client, Father Thaddeus Nguyen Van Ly, in Vietnam, a democracy and religious freedom advocate. This, by the way, is broadcast on national television in Vietnam. Our work on his behalf included everything from winning his case before the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, to holding press conferences, to securing resolutions from the U.S. Congress demanding his release, to publishing op-eds in newspapers. Many groups do pieces of what we do, but if you think about this much like an EKG monitor, a heart monitor, what we found is that if, for example, you were over time to have an op-ed in a newspaper, it would be a little blip on the radar screen of the government, and winning the case at the UN would be another little blip, and having a press conference to call for the person's release, another little blip, right? But actually, in order to get a person out of prison, what we found going up against foreign governments is that you need to combine these actions to have it one very large blip. And so we'll win the case at the UN, have a press conference on Capitol Hill in the case of Father Lee, an op-ed in the Washington Post on the same day. And when you do it that way and you have a serious ebb and then flow of efforts against a government, the government takes notice and has no choice but to do so. So ironically, a constant low level of attention isn't what's going to get a person out of prison. But the same amount of effort, if sequenced in a different way, can actually have an impact to get a person out of prison. So we secured Father Lee's release actually on two prior occasions. This was him at his home in 2010. But what we've learned in many of these kinds of cases is that one needs to remain vigilant. We have, I guess you would say, recidivist clients. Somebody joked that we needed to have a new NGO called Freedom Again for our clients who return to prison. Father Lee is now back in detention, but in a hospital, because he has continued, despite his ongoing health issues and despite his being in and out of prison, to continue to be an advocate for freedom and democracy in Vietnam. And we will, of course, continue to press for his release until he is free and until all people in Vietnam who want to speak out for religious liberty are free to do so as well. And then lastly, what we try to do is we take on cases, as I think you've begun to see, of prisoners of conscience that are illustrative of a broader set of abuses in a country, so that by helping one person, you help a broader class of people. There are clearly plenty of prisoners of conscience and also plenty of people who are arbitrarily detained who need help. But like every NGO, we have limited resources. We currently have 6 full-time staff, an office in London and Washington, and about $1 million annual budget. But the practical reality is many more people than that need help. And so both for strategic reasons, but also for budgetary reasons, we've really tried to focus on helping those people who are the most persecuted in a given society. Because it's our experience that if you can help the person who is most persecuted, not only are they able to return to their families and to their work, but there's a ripple effect within that society which makes it safer for anyone who wants to stand up for their rights to do so. So for example, in mid-2010, we began representing Liu Xiaobo, a leading political activist in China who authored Charter 08, a call for democratic reforms in China. His is, of course, one of the more egregious examples of China's recent crackdown on political dissidents. We were introduced to Liu Xiaobo's wife, Liu Xia, by our former client, Yang Zhanli, who you all met. And several months after we got involved in the case, our case got substantially harder and easier at the same time. Although I'd say primarily harder, when the Norwegian Nobel Committee announced that he was going to be the Nobel Peace Prize laureate for 2010. His wife was swiftly placed under house arrest, and his family and friends were put under close surveillance. And I had the honor and the responsibility of working with the Norwegian Nobel Committee with Yang Zhanli to help arrange the events around the awarding of the prize in December 10th, 2010 in Oslo, and also had the surreal experience at the same time of sitting in the front row alongside Yang Zhanli. Because, of course, having helped get him out of prison and to be there with him for that historic occasion was truly incredibly moving. And, of course, we all remember the iconic image of the empty chair. We've been very active on Liu Xiaobo's case beyond winning his and his wife's case at the UN. We recently worked with our honorary chairman, Desmond Tutu, to have a group of 134 Nobel laureates reach out to now Chinese President Xi Jinping to press for Liu Xiaobo and Liu Xia's release. We followed up this effort with a petition on change.org, which secured the support of about 450,000 plus people calling publicly for their release. And last month, around the Chinese New Year, the Liu Xiaobo Committee, which is really most of the major human rights groups in the world, coordinated the delivery of copies of these 450,000 signatures to a dozen Chinese embassies simultaneously around the world. And of course, our work on their behalf continues unabated. So let me come back around full circle to Burma and then make some closing remarks. The work that Freedom Now does is really all about the personal and the human stories of the people on whose behalf that we fight. And I had another, what I would call an airport moment, in March of 2010, when I was able, with some substantial effort and support from Freedom Now, to secure the release of a Burmese-born American, Nini Ong. This is a picture of him embracing his fiancée outside of Dulles Airport in Washington after 7 months of imprisonment. Despite being an American citizen, his imprisonment included being denied food and water for 10 days, being repeatedly beaten, being kept awake around the clock during interrogation, and a separate five-week stint in a military dog cell in the dark with no bedding and toilet. His story is no different from many of the dissidents that we've represented. Despite having the possibility of leading a comfortable life as a computer scientist, he refused to give up advocating for democracy in Burma, and his grassroots organizing on behalf of political prisoners and, incurred the wrath of the regime. On September 3rd, 2009, he was detained trying to enter Burma to visit his mother, who herself was a political prisoner. She was dying of cancer and being denied medical treatment. He was arrested on false charges, sentenced to 3 years imprisonment and hard labor. And after intensive work privately and publicly, we were able to secure his release. And I think his smile pretty much says it all. Let me just conclude with a few final comments. The Eckenbergs, I think, have wisely pressed in various ways, publicly and privately, at this conference to talk about how do we take the theoretical to the practical. We have, I think, a robust discussion on this panel today, and the next presenter, who I look forward to hearing from, is a UNDP staff person who works with the Office of the Ombudsperson in Ethiopia. Today, currently as we speak, one of our clients who is in prison is an Ethiopian journalist named Iskender Nega, who has an 18-year prison sentence on what I would characterize as sham national security charges. It isn't just my view. We recently had 40 NGOs around the world write to the government of Ethiopia pressing for his release. That included Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Fédération Internationale des Droits de l'Homme, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and many others. And I will announce publicly here today that the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention has recently found as well that he's being held in violation of international law. One practical thing that I would love to come out of this discussion today would be for a commitment that the Office of the Ombudsperson in Ethiopia would take up Iskender Nega's case and raise the case to the executive branch in the Ethiopian government and press for his release. It's high time that it happened. It should have happened a long time ago. But if an ombudsperson's office is going to be of any value to the citizens of a country, it has to be able to work on behalf of those who are most persecuted. Having been involved in this work for a dozen years, what I do find most remarkable is that freedom is a universal value across all cultures. And despite dramatically different domestic situations, every human being yearns to be free and speaks in similar language and in different languages about the need to persevere against oppression. And if there's one thing I want you to remember from my talk here today, it's that the basic liberties that we take for granted here in Canada and around the world, freedom of speech, freedom of association, the right to vote for our own leaders, these are under serious threat around the world. And we have to use our freedom to promote theirs. Let me close, and quite appropriately, with Ms. Betty as a panelist as well, with one of my favorite quotes, which happens to come from Mahatma Gandhi, but whose description of taking on oppressive governments still resonates to this day. Now, of course, you know, he was talking about the British government, but he said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. Thank you very much.
Ms. Mekdes Mezgebu,
and she is currently a program officer with the United Nations Development Program based at the Ethiopian Office of the Ombudsman, where she's predominantly involved in managing capacity development programs. She's also the program and international advisor to the chief ombudsman. She lectures part-time at the Addis Ababa University and at the International Leadership Institute in Addis Ababa. She has a law degree from that university. She also has an LLM degree from Ohio North University from the United States. I think what's significant in terms of this conference and continuity with past conferences is that Megdez was a young leader at the first McGill and Global Eckenberg Family Conference on Human Rights back in 2007, the conference on the prevention of genocide. And she is currently and continues to be engaged as a McGill Eckenberg Fellow. So I'm very pleased to welcome her back, and I think, are you going to say stay
yes,
seated?
I'm good.
Okay.
Yes, I
and
think I'm good.
Let us know if the microphone is very challenging.
Thank you, Colleen. Perhaps I'll start by updating that bio that I've recently left the UN and I'm no longer working for the UN, but I can speak on behalf of the UN because it's only recently that I left. But first, I would really like to thank Gordon and Penny for inviting me back to Montreal. I was one of the first young fellows, Eckenberg Fellows, in 2007. And back then I was a student. But since then, I've gone back home to work with the UN, and not just with the UN, but with a public institution, with a government institution, where the UN really gave me a unique opportunity to work, to be based in a government institution as a UN staff and as an expertise. So I'd really like to talk about how really what Gordon was saying. How does really human rights work in practice? Usually when we talk about human rights, it's government institutions that are in charge of really protecting and promoting human rights. So today I'm going to talk about what are some of the challenges that governments face while trying to address some of the really pressing challenges of human rights at the ground level, at the grassroots level. And so mostly my reference point would be the Office of the Ombudsman and to some extent other sister institutions, as we call them back home, like the Human Rights Commission and the Anti-Corruption Commission. And also I would talk about broadly about other African countries because we were a member of the African Ombudsman Association, which is a continental association that brings together ombudsman institutions and human rights commissions. And we are also a member of the International Ombudsman Institute, which was a universal ombudsman organization. So working with the UN and then again at the Ombudsman and then at the African level, I've been able to see firsthand how human rights is being practiced at the local level and at the African level, and what are some of the challenges in the progress that we're making towards realizing constitutional safeguards that a lot of African countries have in their constitutions, in their documents, and in their principles as principles. So to start with, first, it's institutions of governance. The institutions of governance that we understand them are typically the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. These are like the key institutions of the governance that sort of govern a country. But aside from those institutions, there are other complementary institutions that sort of put government on their toes, and that put governments, that whole government to account. And today, while I talk about democratic governance, I'm gonna start by defining what we mean democratic governance, because whenever we use this really big terms, there are different understanding to them. So as far as this panel and this speech is concerned, for me, how I see democratic governance is in three ways. One, there is the political governance aspect of it. Two, there is the economic governance of a country. And thirdly, there is a corporate governance of a country. And by democratic, I'm going to mean that it's a democratic. It's mostly not about the institutions, but about the procedures. The procedures of decision making, procedures of really handling complaints, and how do we do our day-to-day activities of running a government? What are the procedures? Are they democratic? And by democratic, it means is it transparent, is it responsive, is it effective, is it cost efficient, and at the end, and very crucially, is it accountable? Are our leaders accountable to their constituencies? Are decision makings accountable to the citizens, and et cetera? So, so when we combine these two democratic, the notion of democratic ways of decision making and governance, then the institutions that we talk about are these institutions like the legislative, executive, and judiciary, but also those institutions that control or oversee whether these principles are adhered to. And these are mostly the Office of the Ombudsman, the Human Rights Commission, Electoral Commission, which controls the political governance of a country, and there is the Office of the Auditor General, which controls the economic governance of a country, and also the three institutions that I mentioned, the Ombudsman, Human Rights Commission, and the Anti-Corruption Commission. So these five institutions are very, very crucial and key to any democratic system or any governance system that is out there to sort of implement the laws that we have at the constitutional level or the constitutional safeguards that we have in place and whether the government is really implementing these laws and how much of it is being adhered to. And so I'm going to talk about why it's important to focus on these institutions and to recognize their role, one, to promote their role, and to strengthen their role. And it's important because democratic governments for two very, very important and significant reasons. One, democratic governance and the governance of any democratic country, it's an end in itself. By this, I mean that people deserve good governance, people deserve a democratic governance, and people, the aspiration of any people, any citizen, is to have a good government that is responsive and that is transparent. So when we talk about democratic governance, we can see it as something that is an end in itself, that's something that we can work towards, that we have to aim towards. And secondly, democratic governance, it's something, this idea is something that is a work in progress, but it's been recognized by international organizations like the UN and the World Bank, is that democratic governance is not only necessary, but it's a precondition for development, that is for human development. And if you look at a lot of the indexes that we have on countries that have progressed in human development across the world, those are mostly characterized by a good decision-making power and a good governance. So it is something that needs to be recognized and that is increasingly being recognized in the UN, World Bank, even at the African level. We have a program called NEPAD that has a component, a pillar of for democratic governance as a precondition for development and prosperity. So for these two reasons, it's very important that we pay the attention that institutions of government need and their role on how they are contributing and they should contribute to this process. And coming back to the Office of the Ombudsman and to some extent to the Human Rights Commission, because they are the nature of their work, their relationship is very similar. There is a growing popularity for them, although the notion of the Ombudsman and the Human Rights Commission goes back to almost 200 years ago, where Sweden was the first country to create the institution of the Ombudsman. So you can imagine that a country as democratic, perfectly governed, as prosperous as Sweden would recognize the role of the Ombudsman to create it 200 years ago. And still to this day, the role of the Ombudsman in the Swedish society, in the Swedish way of running a government, it's very significant. And but since then, it has grown in popularity now, where almost all countries in the world either have one or all of these institutions or commissions or human rights commissions. And part of the reasons why it's recognized is because, one, there is a growing demand from people for inclusion, participation, and a cost-effective way of handling complaints or problems. And the Ombudsman and Human Rights Commissions usually provide a very quick access to remedies as opposed to the courts. because when you lodge a complaint, I don't know how much of you are familiar with how an ombudsman works, but whenever somebody has a complaint against a government, and their jurisdictions are different, an ombudsman office only handles cases where it is against a government administration of government, administration of decision-making processes. So if anybody has any complaint against a government office, what you have to do is quickly go, lodge a complaint online, or quickly go to an ombudsman office and make a complaint. And the complaints usually do not take more than 2 or 3 months, depending on the context of the country, to be addressed fully. So it's accessible, it's quick, it's cost-effective, and it's easy to easily dispense with, depending on the nature of the complaint. So for this reason, a lot of countries are demanding, or people are demanding, for the establishment of the ombudsman, as the case is in India, like it was mentioned earlier. And secondly, Human Rights Commission and ombudsman, they conduct investigations or inquiries on their own without the need for complaints or without the need for people to have it and comply. So they would look at a systemic repression, for example, or a systemic case of human rights violation, and these institutions have the mandate to go on their own and inquire and conduct investigations, which is something that is quite different from a judiciary, because their role in making sure that a government is running itself properly can be clearly articulated in this way, where you'd look at a situation where things are going wrong, then you can on your own investigate and inquire and remedy that problem without the need to go into complaints. So there is also a contribution to be made on that sense. And the other one is these institutions are also very important for the domestic application of international law or international treaties. Most countries have domesticated or ratified international treaties, and depending on our own countries, either they are justiciable at the local level or local courts, but their overall implementation of these laws are not documented or articulated. So these institutions have the right one to provide shadow reports to the UN, and also they can issue reports on the level of international on the level of implementation of international law at the domestic level, something that the courts are unable to do. In addition to this, holding government to account is another very important role of these institutions, because the main tool or the main instrument for the ombudsman and for the Human Rights Commission is not prosecution. It's not jailing people. It's mainly naming and shaming public officials. So the way they go about is if there is any government office that is doing wrong, the major tool that is used is naming it and publicly issuing reports that bring to light how government is conducting its business. So this is a very powerful tool that can be used, and that is really effective in holding government to account, something that other institutions may not necessarily be able to do. So for these and other reasons, there is a growing popularity of democratic institutions and their role in ensuring that there is a good governance, or a governance that is accountable and transparent to its people. So while in theory these are how these institutions are supposed to conduct, there are some challenges. And the challenges I can speak about mostly from my own country, but it also can be measured against other African countries. The first one is these institutions mostly, the political commitment that governments have for these institutions vary. Although that there are constitutional safeguards to establish this institutions, unless there is a serious political commitment that would allow them to operate freely, independently, and autonomously, may not be there. In fact, at worst cases, these institutions might be used by governments as instrument of repression, where they are not provided with the right. With the right tools of operation and financial means. In this case, in the Ethiopian case, as far as financial and operational autonomy is concerned, the Office of the Ombudsman has the necessary autonomy. Of course, especially financially, it can like solicit funds from the government, and it's also independent to solicit funds from other agencies, which is how the UN really came in and was supporting the Ombudsman in doing its work. But there are really serious challenges from the executive, which usually in the African case is we have a very, very strong government and we have a weak judiciary, we have a weak legislation, and we have weak institutions of governance. And there are oftentimes influences on these institutions from the executives, something that poses a challenge often too many times. Secondly, the absence of an enabling political environment. For a country like Ethiopia, our Ombudsman Office was established only 5 years ago, and we've only been in operation for a few years. And our overall experiment with democracy has only been less than 10 years, and we've had some very serious bumps on the process where, you know, at some point 6-7 years ago, there was really an opportunity for democratic reforms, but then we had some controversial elections which really took away a lot of the promises that were there. And that serious bump had created an environment where civil society groups and media groups have completely been wiped out. It was interesting to hear from the panel yesterday from Egypt about a draft law that sort of prohibits foreign NGOs or local NGOs from getting foreign funding for works on human rights and governance, which is exactly the case now in Ethiopia, where local NGOs, foreign NGOs cannot work on issues of human rights and governance. And if it's a local NGO who would want to work on human rights and governance, they have to raise their funds from local means. So this is something that's very challenging, because an ombudsman, you know, we are a country that are 90 million country with diverse ethnic groups, diverse religious communities. And, you know, an ombudsman or a human rights commission, however independent and autonomous they are, it's impossible to solve the issues of governance only these institutions. So the role of civil society groups and the role of media groups is critical. So in an environment where media and civil society are not operating at full length, the work of the ombudsman is frustrated, or it is only a drop in the ocean. So I think that is one challenge that we have, where you know, the office is doing as much as it can, but it's not achieving as much as it should. So the right political environment is very important to support the work of these institutions at the broader level. Other challenge is citizen awareness and empowerment. We heard earlier that in India there is the Know Your Citizens' Right campaign, which is something that's very important, I think, because we face the same challenge in Ethiopia where, you know, the democratic culture is not there. Like I said, we only have 10 years of experiment with democracy, 10 or 15 years of democracy, whereas before then we had like 3,000 years of feudalism and a long years of, you know, history of no democracy. So it's very difficult sometimes to engage citizens and talk about rights when, you know, that's something that takes a very long time. And for the ombudsman, from the one side to you know, receive complaints, investigate complaints, run after the government, and at the same time educate the public, it's something that's very overwhelming and difficult to achieve. So that's one challenge. Others are weak capacity, such as human and financial and institutional capacity issues, access issues, where it's very difficult to access populations in the rural areas and these kinds of things. Finally, with all these challenges and problems, I see opportunities for the future, a couple of opportunities, which is, one is the youth bulge, which is, more than 75% of the Ethiopian population and also the African population is under the age of 35. So this is something that is an opportunity. Most governments don't like to think of it as an opportunity, but it is an opportunity because this is a demographic that is increasingly educated and increasingly connected and wired with social networks and new technology, and one that can really demand for rights. So for government, it is a matter of necessity to recognize this youth. And lastly, another opportunity that we have, you know, the post-2012 development agenda is currently being designed at the UN level and at the national level. So democratic governance and the need to support these institutions is something that needs to be supported because they do have a big role to play in governance and human rights protection. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Magdis. And we're running into a little bit of a time issue here. I know we got started a little bit late after lunch, and then we had the young leaders presentation, so our panel started a little bit late. And I think I'm just looking over at the organizers that perhaps we can take about 10 minutes of questions. Yes? 10, 15? 15? 50, so we'll do about 15 minutes of questions, and then we'll finish up the day. So for those of you who would like to have a short question or comment, please make your way to the microphones. Okay. And we had three diverse presentations, but there were overlapping, I think, some important overlapping threads between them in terms of institution building at the local, national, and international level, strategic engagement at the local, national, international level, issues of transparency and accountability, again, running through as a theme. So, yes, the back.
Hi, my name is Daniel Solomon. I'm one of two American young leaders, and I wanted to thank the panelists for their insightful comments on their previous experiences working on human rights issues. My question is for all three of you. One of the sort of topics that captivates me on human rights issues is how we create organizational and institutional cultures of human rights within institutions that are not necessarily sort of oriented towards human rights in the first place. So, you know, whether it's the Indian government or certain components of the United Nations that don't focus on human rights issues specifically, how do we sort of imagine ourselves as agents of social change within bureaucracies and institutions that we tend to view as sort of barriers to that same change? Thank you.
I would probably, if I would answer this brief, I think the foundation of this is education. Criticality is education at the school, at the university level, continuity of that education. Secondly, is absolutely tough enforcement of violation of human rights. So education is prevention, and if that prevention overspills, it is zero tolerance towards enforcement. And obviously, it has to be the right political culture. So three things would continue to ensure human rights.
I think it's also important to empower people. I think empowerment is very very significant in developing that culture, because usually people who are victims of these violations are less empowered, either economically or in other women socially are disempowered. So if we can really empower institutional empowerment, provide institutional, financial, economical, and social empowerment to these people in a way and through education, through time, that democratic culture can be built, I think.
If I could just add a bit here, integrity. I think it's very important. Political integrity is the key to human rights, because corruption eats into the vitals of human rights, because that leads to deprivation and total distraction of governance. And that is basically violating human rights. So corruption is violative of human rights. Therefore, internationally, we got to hit at it very hard.
I'll speak to this just very briefly from an outside-in perspective, because that's the way from which I've been an activist. The UN Human Rights Council is not viewed, unfortunately, very positively because of a range of challenges and how it functions at a political level. But it's actually a much more complex institution than average people think about, because it has a subsidiary group of 50-plus so-called special procedures, working groups, special rapporteurs, and others. And so the UN Human Rights Council is an institution that one has to constantly struggle to fight to actually fulfill its duties under the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and otherwise. And what I have found, and what many people I work with have found, is that if you hold the feet to the fire of the Council as well as of these special procedures to very clearly and unequivocally explain the facts of cases, explain the violations of international law, and press them to act, that you can achieve important things. It doesn't mean that still many challenges don't remain, but as an illustration, just on Thursday, although it didn't get much international media attention, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution on North Korea that has created a commission of inquiry into the mass atrocity crimes going on in North Korea. And this was a resolution that was adopted by consensus among the 47 member states of the UN. This was work that I was personally involved in over a long period of time, representing a group called the Coalition to Stop Crimes Against Humanity in North Korea. And it was no small feat, actually, to get to the outcome that we got to. But it required persistence, a marshaling of the evidence and the facts, and thoughtful strategic deployment of political advocacy. So I think that you really do need civil society and the international community to also, while you have good people on the inside, work from the outside to hold the institutions to their stated missions.
My name is Mohamed Sisse, a PhD candidate at McGill University. I have a question for Mektis from Ethiopia. Critics of governance institutions in Africa often contend that these institutions are window dressing to enhance the reputation of African leaders in the eyes of their international partners. If this critique is true, what do you think, in your view, should international partners do to enhance the effectiveness of these institutions in Africa?
That critique is out there. There are a lot of people who say that, you know, it's these institutions are donor-driven by the World Bank and by, you know, the UN, where they're just established to tick off the list of democratic institutions that are needed to be in place. I wouldn't say that's the case, at least in the Ethiopian case, because these are constitutional institutions, and our constitution has clearly identified institutions of governance that are important for the promotion and protection of human rights, and the constitution was designed almost 20 years ago now. And democratic governance was not a big hot issue as it is now. So for us, it's a matter of constitutional design and constitutional recognition for these institutions and the right they're supposed to further. I can't speak for other countries where that might be the case. However, I do feel like international organizations have a role to play, because they are funding and they are supporting a lot of these institutions, not just in supporting the programs they work for, but in some cases they're also paying the salaries, like the civil service salaries of these institutions in some countries. So I see that they're an opportunity for these institutions to control where the money is going, how it's being used, and where it should be used, so to say, because when we talk about accountability, it's not just accountability of national governments towards their citizens, but it's also accountability of national government to donors and to taxpayers and how that money is being used. So there is an opportunity for international organizations to really influence democratic governments through the money that is going into these institutions.
You'll forgive me for kind of putting it this way, I hope, but I don't know a lot about the Ethiopian Ombudsperson's Office, but I did go to its website. And on the front page of the website, it simultaneously talks about how this is an independent agency of the Ethiopian government. And yet the entire front page is a memorial to Meles Zenawi, the former prime minister, and the legacy of freedom, democracy, and human rights that he left for the people of Ethiopia. And I think it's fair to say, from where I sit and from the clients that I represent, that that's not the full legacy of Meles Zenawi, and that reasonable people might have differing views as to what his legacy is. And so I would say that from a perception standpoint, and from the perception standpoint of the international community, if any institution wants to be viewed as truly independent, then it can't be embracing or memorializing people who led the executive branch. It should stand on its own two feet and focus on its own mission and do its job and do it well. And I think that that is the most effective way for people to believe that these institutions are not window dressing or designed to stand up otherwise somewhat dysfunctional government institutions.
Okay, did you want to respond? Or just quickly, because I think there's another question.
Clearly, I hope I did not portray the assumption that the Office of the Ombudsman is perfect or like the ideal institution in Ethiopia. It has challenges. It has, like I mentioned, challenge of, full independence and autonomy from the executive, which is not unique to our case. But it's the other design, like the design of the institution as far as the constitution is concerned, as far as the proclamation that establishes it is concerned, that allows it to function in a manner that should function. And to that extent, it has been functioning, it has been responding to the needs of the citizens in terms of addressing their quick remedies or the quick problems they're facing with the government. But as far as the broader view of, institutional independence and institutional capacity, we still have a long way to go, and that's clear.
Okay, I believe there's another question. Yes, at the back.
This is very impressive, and I'm really touched by this conference. And of course, coming here as a guest of Dr. Kiran Bedi, being her sister, involved in philosophy and aesthetics, ethics and aesthetics, starting off with social work, all this really interests me. And I'm wondering, really scratching my head, how could a philosopher or an artist transmute the world in world politics and act as a social activist to transmute these blocks into rivers that could flow? And is there a way, my book that I wrote was Truth Over Method, Art Matters. I was wondering for 22 years how to present a certain truth of such blocks, that barriers that we put up in communication, and what would be the method to start communication going and flowing. Would it be hermeneutic method? Would it be didactic method? So Socrates started with this, but we still haven't gotten perfected this method, and therefore we are having this obstruction in justice. So I address three of you. I don't want to favor Dr. Bedi being my sister, but she could.
Okay, wonderful. Sisterly question.
I need sisterly guidance to answer this. I guess you go around speaking out, go about sharing your views. I guess that's the way. That means getting out of your comfort zone every day.
I don't know.
Do you want to say it? Okay. I think we're all intimidated by philosophy, yes. but I think your question really raises a profound idea, which is the importance of speaking across our differences and across different words, languages, peoples, and concepts, and beginning to understand some of the shared kernels of commonality and struggles among which we're engaged. So. Okay, is there any final question or comment?
I think that Wittgenstein pinned it down, that when we're using the word red, we do not have a common interpretation. So it's perhaps that might be a problem of interpretation. And perhaps, make a comment, perhaps we need to focus on freedom of expression and freedom to see how the same word would be interpreted differently across cultures and across the political climate, internationally, nationally, locally, and so on.
Yes, thank you. Okay, I think we'll have the two final questions, and then we'll let each of our panelists respond.
Yes. Thank you, Professor Shepard. My question is to all the panelists, especially Dr. Bedi. We've heard in this conference a very important discussion about how the future of economic power and world power is migrating a little bit to the east, in that China and India are going to be world important players in world events in the future. But obviously, democracy and human rights are a very important point of distinction between the two countries. So in spite of all the headaches in Indian democracy, it's a very great source of hope for all of us who attended this conference. But do you see the model and the influence of India's democracy reaching other countries in the region and indeed the rest of the world in tandem with the Chinese approach that has left most of us here unsettled? Thank you.
And perhaps we'll have the last question, and then I'll turn it over to the panelists. Yes.
My question would go to the, my, if I pronounce this, Mr. Gerrit Janser. Okay. I just curious, how do you think, what is your opinion when Burma is, well, actually I'm from Burma and I'm human rights and democracy activist. So I just curious that how do you think the challenge and opportunity in terms of dealing of the political prisoners in the context of Burma? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And so perhaps we'll begin with the specific question about Burma and then I'll ask the panelists each to say a final word by way of conclusion.
Sure. Well, thanks for the question, and nice to see you. The situation in Burma is challenging and is going to remain challenging for a long time to come, particularly for ethnic minorities, as you know much better than me. Most of the political prisoners in the country, of course, have been released, although provisionally they could still be rearrested at any time. There remain hundreds of political prisoners in the country, and there's been a new commission finally set up at long last to review those sets of questions. But it is clear that Thein Sein is a very different kind of leader than Tan Shwe was. And we're going to have to wait and see how it plays out. The Constitution itself is, I think, the biggest impediment to the future development of the country because it institutionalizes Burman majority rule and is not remotely sensitive to the concerns of ethnic peoples of the country. And as of now, the military government there is, I'm sorry, the now civilian and the military there, civilian government and military there are not willing to talk about reforming the Constitution. But ultimately, that is what's going to need to happen if you're going to see national reconciliation between different peoples in the country. So it's a long and complicated question to answer. I will tell you that having been there now twice in the last couple of months, that there's more hope among all the people I've met, ethnic people, civil society, and the broader population that I've seen for a long time to come. But to get that change that's felt in the cities on civil and political rights to actually filter down to have an impact on people's lives in the country is going to take a long time and is right now really being put on the back of Thein Sein and Aung San Suu Kyi. And so the reform efforts have to be broadened and deepened. It needs to reach Kachin State. It needs to reach the Rohingya. You know, there are a range of peoples who aren't seeing any benefits yet from what's going on. And I would say the Chin, of course, are so far very much among those who have not seen any real change come to your situation.
Okay, thank you for that. And perhaps with respect to the earlier question from Eloge?
India is moving towards two options to answer the economic question. It's either going to be a demographic bomb or it'll be a demographic dividend. Because India is today having 600 to 700 million youth waiting to be employed. So that's a national, a major challenge before Indian economy is how do we upskill them, ensure that they're educated and skilled. And if they are educated and skilled, it could become a major resource skilled provider to the world over. While India, when the rest of the world is aging, Europe is aging, Japan is aging. So India could be that youth dividend. These are the national policies. Now, the point is national policies depend on credible leadership. Credible leadership has to be political leadership. This is what we're heading towards. The coming elections is going to be a turning point. If we elect the right kind, if we elect stable, elect better kind of people, India would move towards becoming a good economic superpower. But if we mess up in the coming general elections, throw up people with criminal backgrounds, or go in for instability, it's going to be difficult for the rest of the world as well. Therefore, it's very, very important that external pressures are also created, which look at some of the institutions which are opaque. Therefore, international audit, international assessments, create pressure back home. So all I said was, help create pressures in certain democracies. Like for instance, when Transparency International rates the corruption index of the countries, it helps civil society. And I think most of these countries are emerging middle classes. So India is moving. That's why the civil society pressure is towards going in for cleaner, have better people in the parliament, more responsible, not corrupt, having right policies, having institutions in place, having the right bureaucracy, letting policing function. If that works, then India could be a major demographic dividend, which will benefit the world over. Because as you know, we still produce one Australia every year. One Australia every year. And India would, a population would stabilize only by 2040. Not till then. So therefore, it's in everybody's interest to see that this democracy works and delivers and stabilizes and sustains. And it could be with this kind of rich heritage, with integrity in politics. I think that's the hope. So we are all working as individuals back home to see this is the way forward.
I could not agree anymore. And I would just like to highlight on the need to really foster and strengthen institutions of governance and institutions of alternative means of handling complaints. And institutions are here to stay. Leaders come and go. People come and go, but institutions are here to stay. So in peaceful as well as in turbulent times and democracies, it's proper and credible institutions that would really respond and take us through some really difficult and transitional times.
Since I'm still getting the mic back, one of the best ways where India's human right is being exercised is to produce children. I think these mothers, there's no compulsion. It has to be education, a slow process of education. And as the march of education moves on, the women are producing less and less children. But it has its own space. You can't fast forward it. There wasn't a politician who tried to fast forward it and lost the next elections. So everybody's scared to fast forward it. So it will have to be the march of time, education, etc. till 2040. So India is a great example where parents exercise the best human right is to have as many children as they want.
I'll just make a last comment about China, because I think we've hit on India, although we need to keep talking about India as well, because I agree fully with what both of my colleagues here have said. On China, I actually have a lot of hope. A country of 1.3 billion people, which has annually these days about 130,000 protests. Mobile telephony has penetrated throughout the society. The great Chinese firewall is much more easy to penetrate today than it's ever been before. And information combined with a desire of the people to live better lives is putting immense pressure on the Chinese party, Communist Party, and the one-party system, which inherently is not going to be able to sustain itself unless it starts to adapt. And I tend to defer to my friend Yang Zhanli on all things China and his brilliant observations. But the only last thing I'll say is that I think that we're going to see a splintering of power within the Chinese Communist Party in the next several years. You might see a two-party system unfold in the near term. But it's clear that the people of China have deep concerns, not just about civil and political rights, although they have some concerns about that, but about corruption, about the environment, about labor rights, and about a whole host of really simple bread and butter issues that affect their lives on a daily basis. So China deserves immense credit for lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. It's truly an economic miracle. The Chinese people are exceptionally hardworking and are highly capable. And I suspect that they will also be able to adapt their governmental system to respond to the needs of the population. it's of course taking a lot longer than many of us on the outside would like, and those who are persecuted on the inside would definitely like. But I think that in partnership with friends inside and outside China, China will see a very different system in the coming decades.
Okay, thank you to our panelists. And before I join, thank them a bit more formally, I just wanted to take a moment to say a few words by way of closure, because this is our last panel for this wonderful conference, and we've traversed continents. We've heard the expression of diverse and divergent ideas, and we've talked about the importance of, we've talked across generations, across countries, across, and I think that's what conferences are really all about. And I've certainly found it very challenging working with the organizing team and on behalf of all of us. It's been a tremendous learning experience putting together this conference, and it's been a challenge given the enormity of the themes. But I think the ideals really did come through, and that was that we're concerned about human rights, but democracy takes us to the point where we need to also talk about engagement and the multiple ways in which we work together and in solidarity towards securing the protection of human rights. So I just wanted to thank all of you for coming to the conference and for participating and engaging with us in this project. And so thanks very much. And I think I don't really want to, as one of the speakers said, I think it was Alan Young said, we should not close the conference. It's really the opening and the continuing dialogue, and hopefully our relationships and some of the relationships we've forged over the past few days will continue to be strengthened, and we'll continue to learn from each other as we move forward. So I just want to, and on a final note, on behalf of all of us here, I just ask you to join me in thanking our three speakers for their wonderful presentations, and thank you once again.